ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Corbin Middlemass here from ABC Cricket Podcast. There has never been a more anticipated Ashes series than the one going down this summer. Australia versus England is always huge, but this feels generationally massive. A crucial clash needs a comprehensive analysis. So check out ABC Cricket Podcast. Join me and ex-Australia opener Ed Cowan every Monday and Friday, as well as after every day of play for the best conversation in cricket. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here. This week, I'm speaking with ABC presenters and journalists about their best stories and interviews from 2025. I'm joined by Alan Kohler, Stephanie March, Lee Sales, and Sarah Ferguson. Today, though, it's Matt Bevan from the If You're Listening podcast on some of the controversial characters in Donald Trump's orbit. Matt, Donald Trump, in his first year back in office, he really surrounded himself with a lot of interesting, I guess you'd say, characters, promoting many of them, of course, to really, really senior roles. He is not shy of jobs for his mates, is he?
No, absolutely not. And ironically, the people that he hires are also very nepotistic in their hiring practices, in their life outside of the White House. So their previous career was also riddled with nepotism. So, they've come into the White House in a very jobs for the boys sort of a situation, as we would call that in Australia.
Yes.
Very interesting people. And they are having, you know, mixed success.
And some of them aren't particularly qualified for those roles. Now, you have spent the year having a pretty good look at some of these people, which sounds like a bit of fun. Now, one of them, of course, is Steve Witkoff. Now, you know, Trump and Witkoff, they've been friends for like almost ever.
They sure have. It's fascinating listening to interviews with Steve Witkoff because he talks about how much he idolised Donald Trump when he first met him. They first met in the 1980s. Steve was a property lawyer and Donald Trump was one of his firm's clients. Steve Witkoff talks about how Donald Trump would come into the office and Steve Witkoff would say to himself, "I want to be that man." Not, "I want to be his friend, I want to be him."
Right.
By the way, everybody wanted to be him. He'd come to 101 Park Avenue where I was a lawyer. He had this swashbuckling style. I used to see him come in and I used to say, "God, I want to be him."
And so that was his attitude towards Donald Trump. But then they had a chance encounter at a New York deli when Donald Trump was trying to order a ham and Swiss sandwich but didn't have any cash on him. Donald Trump strikes me as the sort of person that doesn't carry a lot of cash around.
Yeah.
And Steve Witkoff recognized him and paid for his sandwich. And then a few years later, they ran into each other and Donald Trump said, "You're the man from the sandwich incident." And they became close friends, mainly golfing buddies.
Yep.
But also Witkoff started basically trying to live out his dream of becoming Donald Trump and followed him into the property development industry. Mm. Witkoff owns much more of Manhattan than Donald Trump does. But, you know, without looking at their books, it's hard to say definitively that he's more but he's got a bigger footprint, I suppose, across Manhattan than Donald Trump.
Yeah. And by the way, the sandwich was ham and Swiss cheese, right?
Yes, I believe so, yes.
So I hope it was toasted. They're never nice, right? You got to toast these things.
Well, I mean, you certainly do in this country, but look, they do magical things with food in America.
they do.
They turn things that don't seem like they could possibly be edible into the most delicious thing you've ever eaten.
So anyway, okay, well, they bonded over property, they bonded over golf, but actually they also bonded over a pretty big tragedy, didn't they? Because Steve Witkoff's son died. And Trump was a friend during that time.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve Witkoff has several children and one of them, well, Steve Witkoff describes him as quite a sensitive, artsy type of kid. he would also regularly go and give money and food to the homeless people that lived outside buildings that Steve Witkoff's company was involved in, and built relationships with a lot of people who were a lot less fortunate. But he also got into drugs, and he went into rehab and then was at a halfway house where he was supposed to be, you know, segueing back into society after his time in rehab, and he overdosed at that halfway house and he died. Mm. And it was this horrifying experience for Steve Witkoff, as I imagine it would be for any father. And he talks about how Donald Trump got in touch with him and spent a lot of time with him and was very kind to him and supportive through that process, and how it, you know, led to them having a very close relationship with each other.
When I lost my boy Andrew to an opioid overdose, the pain was unbearable. But as usual, Donald Trump showed up. After Andrew passed away, I found myself clinging to my son's memory, even his things. His college ID is in my pocket right now. I wear his ring since he died.
But the other interesting thing is that Witkoff says that in himself, it instilled a desire to try and live up to his son's legacy of looking after people who are less fortunate and giving things. And I think that is clearly the motivation behind him wanting to get involved in the Trump administration. This time, he said to Donald Trump during a round of golf, "When you go back into the White House, can I be some sort of a peace envoy? I want to deal with peace in the Middle East." And Donald Trump said, "Yeah, whatever you want, man."
Yeah.
And so he's appointed him to that role. And so Witkoff has been traveling around the world trying to solve wars.
US President Donald Trump says Steve Witkoff, his special envoy, will travel to Moscow this week with the hope he can help broker a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine.
The US will dispatch its envoy Steve Witkoff to Israel for the first time in 3 months to discuss the humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
And look, you can't fault him for trying, but whether he's competent, that's another question.
Yes, because what he lacks in experience, he has made up for in cliches, right?
Yes, cliches and yes, enthusiasm and cliches. He likes to talk about putting himself in the shoes of other people.
I'm always trying to put myself in the shoes of the other person, because a good deal has to work for everybody.
He talks about it a little bit as though nobody's ever thought of that before. You know, that I go into a negotiation and I really try and put myself in the shoes of the other person. And, yes. And we're supposed to be like, oh, what a novel idea.
And he has a pretty simplistic approach to solving wars. That was pretty evident during an interview with Tucker Carlson.
Yeah, it definitely was. He's sort of going, yeah, well, I just want to find a way that everybody can be happy. And, yeah. You know, the concept that maybe, you know, people with contradictory desires, like, for example, the Israeli government and Hamas, possibly there isn't a deal that both of them can be happy with.
It's important for me to know or to have a feeling of where the Israelis want to get to. What about the Qataris? They're the mediators at the table. What do they want to accomplish here? What about Hamas? Where are they?
And he sort of talked about this in this meeting and said, look, I got an idea of what Israel wanted, and I got an idea of what Qatar wanted, who were the negotiating party, and then I got an idea of what Hamas wanted. And obviously what Hamas wants is unacceptable. And so, yeah. So it's like, well, how exactly are we getting to a deal here if you're declaring what one side wants to be unacceptable?
I think they want to stay there till the end of time and they want to rule Gaza, and that's unacceptable. So we have to know that. We had to know what they wanted. What they want is unacceptable.
But the surprising thing is that since we put out the episode on that, there has been not a peace deal, but a ceasefire in Gaza. Mm. Although the key thing there seems to have been more the Trump administration putting pressure on Israel rather than putting pressure on Hamas.
Mm. Well, obviously, he was also tasked with helping to end the war in Ukraine. So off he went to Moscow a couple of times. But, oh gosh, Matt, you've got to tell me, because during one of these visits, he didn't take a translator, but he was relying on a Russian one.
Yeah. whenever there's these summits, there'll be a wire service camera. So from the Associated Press or you know, Russia's equivalent, will go in there and sort of film them going into the room together, shaking hands, saying hello, sitting down at the table. They'll take a few pictures and then the media will go out and they'll actually have the meeting. But in this wire service footage, you can see Witkoff come in, shake hands with Vladimir Putin, and then go over to the table where Putin is sitting down on the other side of it, and Witkoff goes to sit down and he sees a woman coming to sit down next to him, and he looks at her and goes, "Ah, you're the translator from the embassy." And they sit down together and they proceed with the meeting. Now, she wasn't the translator from the embassy. She was, in fact, one of Vladimir Putin's aides, but she was happy to translate for this man. And so, basically, Witkoff was in there with a whole bunch of Russians and nobody else. And so there's a number of really good reasons why that's not usually the way that negotiations are carried out. And one of those came to light a few months later when, you know, Witkoff had another summit with Putin without a translator. But without bringing a translator, I mean, someone was translating. And Witkoff returned home to the United States and told Donald Trump, "Look, Putin's ready to make a ceasefire deal. Putin's ready to do a land swap, give up these parts of the territory that he's occupied in Ukraine in exchange for keeping those parts. So there we go. We can sort it all out. And why don't you call Vladimir Putin to come to a summit in Alaska and we can end this war." And they did that, and it became clear that Vladimir Putin was not willing to give up any land at all.
Something was lost in translation?
Yes, something was very much lost in translation. And what Putin had agreed to give up was sort of like this single town here and maybe that, you know, railway junction there in exchange for we'll have all the rest of the land that we've captured, thank you very much. Witkoff totally misunderstood that.
Putin's a very smart guy. You know, someone said to me, "You know, you got to watch it because he's an ex-KGB guy. He could be looking to manipulate you." I don't regard Putin as a bad guy. I liked him. I thought he was straight up with me.
So he's not a seasoned peace negotiator, but he's been giving it a red hot go.
That's right. It's the thought that counts. The effort that counts
absolutely.
In these things.
Okay, well, let's now turn to another of these Trump appointees, that is Howard Lutnick. Now, he's Trump's commerce secretary, but what's his backstory? He's a smiley guy. He's always smiling, right?
He's an unbelievably friendly-looking man. He's always grinning in all the interviews.
Yeah,
he seems unflappable. You can ask him any question about the tariff system that you want, and he'll just smile his way through it and answer it in a very jolly, lighthearted way. But similar to Steve Witkoff, he has a really very tragic backstory and a traumatic backstory that revolves around the most traumatic experience that the United States has had over the last 25 years, which was, of course, the attacks on 9/11. At the time, Howard Lutnick was the chairman of Cantor Fitzgerald, which was a financial services firm that was on floors 101 to 105 of the North Tower of the World Trade Center. But on 9/11, it was the first day of school for his son, Kyle, and he'd taken his son to school for that first day. There's this photograph of the two of them together outside Kyle's school uptown.
Then when you took a photograph, they would put the time on the lower right-hand corner in like an LED little orange thing. So I have a picture of me with my son in front of the school at 8:46. Plane hits the building 8:48.
And it was pure luck that Howard wasn't in the tower at the time. But of his staff, more than 650 were in the tower at the time. And as the day progressed, it eventually became clear that none of those people had survived. And that was particularly horrific for the people involved, more so than it would be, I think, with a lot of other companies, because Cantor Fitzgerald had a policy of nepotism, basically, a deliberate policy of nepotism where people hired friends, hired relatives. There were, I think, 29 sets of siblings working at the company. Howard Lutnick's brother was working at the company and was in the office that day. So was Howard Lutnick's best friend. whole, you know, family groups, sibling groups were wiped out on that day. And it was truly a horrifying experience, clearly, for Howard Lutnick, because in the days afterwards, he really broke down into tears in every media interview he did and became, in the first few days, became really a voice for the families of the victims. But then he did something that turned him into arguably the most hated person in America.
What was that?
He stopped paying paychecks to all the people who had died, and he backdated that to the time that the plane hit the building.
Gosh.
The implication was, well, you weren't working anymore, and so you don't get any more money. And obviously this was seen as an unbelievably horrifying and heartless thing for him to do. And he went on Larry King's show at the time to talk about this.
They call me and they say, how come you can't pay my salary? Why can't you pay my husband's salary? Other companies pay their salary. Why can't you? But you see, I lost everybody in the company. So
now you're gonna
I can't pay their salaries. So they think we're doing something wrong.
And understandably, a lot of people were very, very, very angry at him. But he argued that there was a strategy behind what he was doing. And really what he was doing was taking a truly massive, massive gamble that he really, really hoped would pay off. The gamble was he recognized that if he continued to pay the paychecks to the two-thirds of his staff that had died while the company was unable to operate, the company would go out of business incredibly quickly. So what he decided was, I will stop paying the paychecks and I will rescue the business. I will start the business up and running in as quickly as humanly possible. Mm-hmm. Just an indication of how, you know, extraordinary this whole event was. They had all their files on computers in their office, obviously, at the top of the North Tower. And they had backups, which were stored in the basement of the South Tower, because nobody thought that anything would happen to both towers at once. They managed to sort of pull things back together from various backups in various places. They had a London office that was able to sort of pick up some of the slack, and they got some office space in New Jersey and started the business up out of there and were back on the stock market as soon as possible and turned around and became profitable again.
Yeah.
And at that point, he started paying large amounts of the profits to the families of the victims who had died there. And so the families of the victims got more money in the long term than they would have otherwise. And he's also employed large numbers of the victims' family members. Yeah. He's employed 57 children of the staff members who had died on 9/11.
Yeah, so it was a huge gamble.
Yeah.
That paid off.
Yeah.
So he went from hero to villain to hero again. And then, of course, he took another huge gamble because he managed to get in with Trump into his administration, but he was in charge of implementing the tariffs that basically every economist in the world think are not a very good idea.
Yeah. So I guess my theory, I mean, I don't have, you know, evidence of this. This is a theory. My theory is that he had taken a gamble that was so extraordinary and so dangerous, and it paid off, you know? And so his lesson out of that is two things. One, my life can't possibly get any worse than it was on that day. And two, sometimes you make a big gamble and it pays off. In fact, most of the gambles that he's taken in his life have paid off. He's a billionaire. So he's come in and he's met with Elon Musk during the last stages of the campaign, and the two of them basically decided that they were going to fix the US economy together. Elon Musk would cut back on government spending through his Doge program, so that would bring down the amount of money that was being spent, and Howard Lutnick would use tariffs to increase the revenue of the federal government and balance the budget, bring it back, the budget back into balance.
But you're going to see over the next month or so, we're going to roll out dozens of deals because we'll find categories of countries that it'll work out just fine.
Now, there's a million reasons why that's not going to work.
Yeah.
And in fact, now we very much know that it has not, because Elon Musk is out of there and he did not cut the US budget to the level that he said he was going to.
Right.
Meanwhile, Howard Lutnick has implemented these tariffs and is defending these tariffs as much as he can. But, you know, now the United States is now seeing price rises and people are noticing that they are paying more for groceries than they used to, which is causing Donald Trump to have to sort of back down a little bit on some of these tariff programs.
Yeah, it's been chaotic.
Yeah, but I think the thing about Howard Lutnick is his ability to put up with criticism is higher than I think anybody else on the planet possibly, given what he went through in 2001. And so he's going to stick with it as long as the boss wants him to.
Well, Matt, you've obviously also looked into other Trump appointees, including Robert F. Kennedy, who is his health secretary.
Mm-hmm.
An interesting choice, of course.
Another family famous for nepotism.
Yes, exactly. And some very questionable policies coming from him. But just tell me overall, though, what do you think of Trump's tactic surrounding himself by mates, if you like? Does it work for him, do you think, or not in the long run?
I think his lesson from his first term was that it's difficult to trust people. He, in his life, has always run his business very nepotistically, obviously. Mm-hmm. His children are the key figures. It's a family-owned and family-operated business. Still, it's not listed on the stock market. The Trump family owns the whole company. So his whole career has been telling him to trust your family, trust people you know really well. His first administration was riddled with people who did not do what he told them to. In many cases, deliberately tried to undermine him and prevent him from implementing policies that he tried to do. If you're putting yourself in Donald Trump's shoes, his experience throughout the first term was one of being backstabbed, undermined, and ignored by his own staff, by the serious people that he wanted to bring into the administration. And the lesson that he's learned from that is absolutely just don't do that.
Mm.
Bring in people who are loyal to you, who trust you, who will do what you say.
Yeah.
And so far that seems to be working for him,
mm-hmm.
with the exception perhaps of Elon Musk.
Yeah.
But mostly he's now found people who are willing to do what he tells them to. When he says, I want to send the National Guard into Los Angeles in order to stop these protests, it happens.
Yeah.
When he says he wants to deport people to a prison in El Salvador, it happens.
Mm.
And this is certainly, in his mind, a much better way of operating. Whether it leads to good economic and social outcomes, you know, that's a separate question. But
yeah,
from his perspective, this is exactly what he wanted his first administration to be like. And that's certainly the way he's running his second administration.
Yeah, he just has the lives of all Americans in his hands. But anyway, all right. Well, Matt, if people haven't heard all your episodes of the podcast this year, they have plenty of time, don't they, now?
Yes,
to walk
summertime
along the beach, listening
absolutely
to you in their headphones would be perfect, perfect time.
Absolutely. It is absolutely the perfect time. They can absolutely listen to the back catalogue, but we've actually, excitingly, Sam, we've
yes
got a four-part documentary series that is coming out in January that we have been working on extremely hard. It's going to be broadcast on ABC TV, as in the proper, like ABC One, ABC
oh
proper
my gosh,
TV.
The actual ABC.
The actual ABC TV.
You've made it.
It'll be available on our podcast feed and on our YouTube channel throughout January. It is about predicting the future,
mm-hmm.
and why that's a bad idea.
Oh, I was going to say, sounds great. All right, well, looking forward to it, Matt. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Enjoy Sam.
Enjoy a break and a holiday.
Happy holidays.
Thank you. Matt Bevan is the host of the If You're Listening podcast. Find it on the ABC Listen app. Join me tomorrow on ABC News Daily. I'll be joined by Lee Sales from Australian Story on the most memorable episodes of the past year. And on Friday, join me with 7:30 presenter Sarah Ferguson.
This episode was produced by Sydney Peed. Audio production by Cinnamon Nippard. Our supervising producer is David Cody. You can find past episodes of ABC News Daily on the ABC Listen app. I'm Sam Hawley. Thanks for listening.